Okay, my name is David Craner, and I am 40 years old, and this is October 7th, 2012, in Washington, D.C., and I am interviewing my father, and he will give his name and information.
My name is Gary Craner. My age is 72. Date of birth is 5/21/40. Date of today is October 7th, 2012. Location, Washington, D.C., and relationship is I'm the father.
Okay, so let's start with your time in Vietnam. And let's start with the first time you remember hearing of Vietnam. When was the... Do you remember the first time you started hearing about it, you know, in the news or whatever, that this was something that people your age were going to or something?
1965.
And what were you hearing about it then? What were your thoughts about it?
Well, they were just moving select forces in there to help train the South Vietnamese to kind of take care of themselves. And I thought it was just a military action at that point in time.
And you were, at that point, you were 25 then?
Yes.
And how long after that did you start to think that this was something you might end up being involved in?
Well, I really didn't think I'd wind up being involved in it, but because I was in college and had a 2S deferment and all that kind of stuff, so I didn't think I'd wind up being there.
But at some point in time, it became apparent that you were going to be there. When was that?
I was in 1964. It was 1964, I guess. I realized that I got my dates kind of mixed up, I guess. I heard about it before 64, I-65, I heard about it in 62, I guess, about 1964, that I decided that I was probably going to wind up going to Vietnam, even though I was in college and I was had a wife and two kids, and I could not be drafted or would not be drafted from that standpoint, but I was still probably going to go because of some external reasons, I guess.
And so I guess, what were those external reasons?
I had two of them. One, my father never went to the Second World War, and he beat himself up about that for all of his life that I knew him. And my uncles and all them always kidded him and give him a hard time about that. So I thought, well, I don't want to go through that for the rest of my life. This thing is developing into a full-blown war, and I'm not going to want to beat myself up for all my life, so I'm going to go and see what it's all about. And number two, being a college-age student, I didn't believe a lot of the rhetoric that I was hearing about it, and I really wanted to go just to see for myself what it was all about, what we were really over there for and what we were trying to accomplish and all that kind of stuff. And I knew I couldn't do it listening to what people were saying stateside.
So was it kind of like an adventure in your mind? Was that how you were kind of seeing it? Or was it more out of curiosity about the politics of it or what happened?
I think it was more curiosity than anything else, just to make sure that what we were over there for, it was what we were there over there for. From that standpoint, yeah.
Okay. And so you volunteered to go. That's how you ended up going. You weren't drafted or anything.
Absolutely. Volunteered and fought to get to go.
And so how did you end up, did you choose the Army or did the Army choose you? How does that work?
No, I just went in. I was in the Army ROTC at college, so I just went into the Army. I graduated and got a commission in the service, so that was the only smart way to go as an officer.
So when did you join the ROTC, I guess, then?
Well, I used ROTC to stay out of college, stay out of the war. So I, immediately when I went to college, I signed up for ROTC.
And what year would that have been?
That was 58.
Okay. And so when you were done with college, and that what year was that?
1965.
Okay. And so then you took your took a commission in the military. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's exactly.
Okay. Okay. And so by that time, you knew that you'd be going to Vietnam because you'd be an officer, and that's what happened.
Well, pretty much. After I got my commission, I had to go to Fort Belvoir, Virginia, to be trained as an engineer officer. There wasn't anything really set whenever you actually got your commission. You could go as infantry or anything else. And I wound up, of course, being an engineer. That they were about half smart and sent me to engineer training, yeah, so I could be a combat engineer. So.
And did you have any say in that, or did they just tell you what you were going to be doing?
I don't remember having much say in it, other than the fact that it was just kind of a foregone conclusion that since I had a degree in engineering, I'd be going in the Corps of Engineers.
And so you went to Fort Belvoir and you had some training, and then where did you go next?
Then from there, I went to Fort Polk, Louisiana, and I did have some say in that because I limited my assignments to some place in the South, and that's where I wound up, to the armpit of the United States Army.
And so what did you do there in Fort Polk? What was your role?
I was a post-range officer. I was in charge of the firing ranges and training the people and shooting their weapons and that kind of stuff. And that's basically what I did for the whole year.
And was that a time while you were basically waiting to ship out to Vietnam? Or you know, why would it be after training that they would send you to something like that, I guess?
They weren't really taking officers until they had about a year under their belt in service. They were scared to have them over there. More of a liability than they were of any positive effect on what they were doing. So they let you go on assignment for about a year.
Okay. And so then from Fort Polk, where did you go next?
Well, I was signed, went to Vietnam. I went directly from Vietnam. Sent my wife up to Chicago to be close to her family, and we went up there and found a place for them to live, and actually in Zion, Illinois, is where they went, and I shipped out right directly from Zion to Vietnam.
And so the time between the time that you took your commission and you shipped out, how was the war going at that point in time, and what were your thoughts about it during that time period?
They were ramping up in 67. That's when they hit basically their high point of numbers of people over in Vietnam, and also the first big go-round in Tet. Everybody hears the famous Tet. Well, 67 Tet was the one where they made the charge at Saigon and all over the country from that standpoint.
And so, and what were your thoughts about the war at, you know, in any way? Like, were you more scared? Were you becoming more in favor of it, more opposed to it?
Well, you can't be scared but about the first 3 days. And after that, you have to settle on the fact that it ain't going to happen to me. Nothing's going to happen to me. And otherwise, you can't live with yourself. You just go nuts. And I saw some people do that. But beyond that, our job was to build a highway from from Cameron Bay, which was a major port that we had built in there, to all the way to Hanoi, I don't know if we could eventually. And they didn't have any kind of roads, and so we were busy building a road. So we were doing something in behalf of the Vietnamese people, providing them with something. My group was, but we had a lot of hang-ups with doing that, a lot of interferences. You know, I never did understand why they were messing with us when we were trying to do something that was of a big advantage to them, and we would leave it, you know, be gone with it. And we got one of my jobs. I had a survey crew, a soils testing crew, and a EOD team, explosive ordnance demolition team. And every morning we had to go out on the road and would dig up maybe 100 number 10 cans in order to find one bouncing Betty that they had put in.
What's a bouncing Betty, I guess?
Well, that's a grenade-type object that bounces up about 4 foot above the ground. When you hit it, it's spring-loaded, bounces up about 4 foot above ground and explodes.
And what's a number 10 can then?
Number 10 can is like a big old can of orange juice or something like that from that sample.
So they would plant decoys, is that what you're saying?
They'd put 100 of them out there, and we'd spend, you know, 2 hours in the morning making sure, probing everything. And we didn't have the fancy equipment at that time that you could sonar or anything, so we had to do it with our bayonets. We had to go out there with bayonets, a team of about 12 guys.
But so that's in country. When you were in the States before you left, and that time when you were at Fort Belvoir and Fort Polk, what were your thoughts about the war before you were, you know, in the middle of it?
Well, I didn't really have any other thoughts than I'd had before. I had serious doubts about what we were there to accomplish. And I had a lot of doubts even in country, except after I started questioning why, when I was fired upon, that I had to call in the battalion headquarters and find out if I could fire back. And at that point in time, I found out that a lot of the villages that we were fooling with that had built up on the side of the road, and we had to go through and negotiate with them in order to tear down their shacks and stuff and build them back off the side of the road some, that they had friendlies in there. But they would act as non-friendlies to the other side, let them come in at night and set up these bouncing Bettys to dig the holes, do all that stuff, to actually fire rockets on us, to do all those kind of things that I didn't understand why they were doing it in the first place, like I said before, because we were providing something of good of value to them that we would wind up walking off and leaving. But it was finally explained to me that by some higher-ups that what we were doing was fighting a defensive war over there. We were not fighting an offensive war. Obviously, we would go in there in a couple of days, take everything out, and be in charge of everything. But they didn't want to do Japan all over again. They went in there and nuked Japan, and then they wound up for 25 years and $25 billion later, building all their infrastructure back, building all their schools, highways, getting their towns back together and getting leadership and everything in there and trained in democracy, so to speak. That's exactly what they did not want to do in Vietnam. They thought that if we fought a defensive war there for about 6 or 7 years, that we could walk away. They would be strong enough to take care of themselves, and we would have built enough stuff to help them with their infrastructure and all that kind of stuff. And that kind of made sense to me at that point in time.
And before you left for the war, would you have said you were in favor of the war effort or opposed to it, or you were neutral?
I think I was neutral. I didn't believe what I was hearing. I wasn't sure what I was hearing. So,
well, what were you hearing?
Well, it was a anti-communism thing, you know, and that's what we were trying to keep them from turning into communists and communists overtaking them and all that kind of stuff.
So the domino theory type stuff.
Yeah, I didn't see it. You know, I just didn't see it.
Hang on, let me pause here. Okay, so what was your first memory within Vietnam? You know, walking off the plane or whatever. You know, that's always a big moment in the movie. You know, that first moment?
Not off the plane. Didn't bother me, just like any other, getting off any other plane. But when I got on the bus and going to the compound, all the training I'd had, all the adversaries were wearing black pajamas. Well, everybody up and down the street was wearing black pajamas. And I didn't have no weapons, so I was very nervous, very nervous. Every time I'd see somebody, they were in black pajamas, and they were the, you know, they were the aggressor, or as you would say, in all kind of training that I had. So.
And so the flight over, let's talk about that real quick. You left from Fort Polk, and was it, I guess, not a direct flight or something? How was that, the whole trip itself?
No, I actually left. I flew from Chicago to San Francisco on just a regular ticket. And then at San Francisco is where we mustered up. And we flew from San Francisco to Guam, and then on into Vietnam. And the entry into Vietnam was like a 90-degree. It's like the plane died. It just was flying along, and all of a sudden, boom, just dropped into Vietnam because they didn't want to be, because they were shooting at us at that point in time.
And so what other thoughts about, you know, this is your probably your first time in a you know, country that was so different from the United States. What else do you remember from that bus trip? Was there like a culture shock moment?
No, because it looked very similar to the villages and everything that they had built over here in the United States to train on in Vietnam. I mean, at Fort Polk and other places. So it was a very familiar surrounding to us from at that point in time.
And when you say you mustered up, did you know these guys you beforehand, the people you were going with, or were the people you were going with the people you were going to be with in country?
No, that was one of the big lessons that we tried to teach everybody when we came back. We all went over there individually. Didn't know anybody, came back individually. Knew very few people when we came back. And we said, that just doesn't work, because when they come over individually, you don't know them, you don't trust them, you don't know anything about them, you don't know whether they got your back or not. And it takes a good while over there, 2 or 3 months, before you really feel comfortable with a new guy that comes in country. If you've trained with them for 6 months, and you all go together as a group, you know who's going to take your back. You know who you trust and who you don't trust. And if you'll notice, all the movements in Iraq, all the movements in the Gulf War, all the movements, and they listened to us. They did what we said. They sent them over in a group. They bring them back in a group. And they replace them with another group. And there's a lot more comfort in that. In that situation, a lot more trust, and that's the only way to really do it.
So, when you think of getting to Vietnam, what would be the thought of that moment, of that, you know, original introduction to the country?
I got 365 more days.
And did you keep track of days? Did you always know how many more days you had, or would that drive you crazy if you tried to do that?
You have a short timer's calendar, and you usually it's a naked woman, and you're just drawing in, coloring in parts on her until you get, you know, until you get down to 365th.
How did the war change you?
That's a tough question. I don't know. I think about that for a minute.
Okay, we'll come back to that one. During your service, can you recall times? What are your strongest memories? You know, times that you were afraid, times that you were happy, or times you felt like you'd accomplished something.
We had a lot of goals as far as building the road, and we exceeded almost all those goals every time we turned around. It'd be, you know, so many miles of a highway laid and doing those kinds of things, and we were expected to get to just south of Whiskey Mountain whenever we went past Whiskey Mountain. We even moved another group up on top of Whiskey Mountain to take over for us whenever we left. And so from that standpoint, we had a lot of good things. I think I found out during Tet, we were surrounded during Tet. There was more than a battalion, and we were only a company. a battalion is four times the size of a company, surrounded us where we were located on out there on the road, and they were on their way to the train. And they wanted to make a lot of damage in the train, and they were just going to overrun us. And then they realized that from the insiders that they had in our camp, we had people working in our camp. From the insiders in there, they knew what our outside perimeters looked like. We had napalm all over our outside. And if they had tried to come in, well, they did try to come in once. They run a herd of elephants through in front of the company or so, about a company size that was coming. Run a herd of elephants in there, and we burned them all up, and a bunch of the Viet Cong along with them. And of course, we replenished that. And they knew if they tried to run a battalion through us that they were going to suffer some severe damages, you know.
When you say you had napalm set up, I mean, we're talking about like in bags? I don't know how that works.
Napalm is like it's like a bomb that they strap to the planes and all that kind of stuff. And we just had a trigger mechanism where we blew them up, you know, with a grenade. We could do that even remotely if we needed to. We're engineers, you know.
And was that the time you were most concerned for your life, or?
No, I was not very concerned for my life. That's the first time I really realized what it was like to be thirsty. We ran out of drinking water. We were there for 22 days and consumed all of our drinking water. I didn't have any drinking water. And it got really... And you get into the rationing and doing all that kind of stuff, and one cup a day, half a cup a day, and it's hot. It's hot and muggy there. You really realize what it's like to be thirsty. And we got so thirsty that we put together a convoy to go out of the camp, to go back down to Cameron Bay and get fresh drinking water. And we loaded up three Jeeps with 50 calibers. And a deuce and a half with a 50 caliber on it, and took off like striped ass apes, you know, and they didn't touch us, didn't try us.
And so you guys got more water, and that's how, yeah.
We got down to Cameron Bay and loaded up and came back and thought, well, here we go, you know, we'll come back. They missed their chance coming out. They'll rip us a good one coming in. They didn't touch us. They never tried us. Their number one objective was to go into the train and make serious damages in the train, and they just couldn't afford to lose any more people. So they didn't. They left us alone. They finally went way around us and went into the train, hitting the train pretty heavy.
And so, well, when was the time that you recall being most afraid or concerned?
The first 3 days in country. And we've got bombs down at Cameron Bay is where I came in, and we got bombs down there every night, you know.
Do you think it was because it was the most dangerous time, or just because you were so new to it and your imagination was running?
I was so new to it, and I thought, God, how can you live through a year of this, you know? There's no way this is going to work out, you know, but it wasn't that bad. I say, after about my third day, and I think I talked to a lot of other people, it was about 3 or 4 days for all of them before we realized that we have to settle on the fact nothing's going to happen to me. You know, we'll just go on and take care of business, and nothing's going to happen to me, and so away you go.
And so you built roads, or did you do more, was there more to your job than just building roads, or that's pretty much what you did?
Well, I think one of the worst parts of my job was I got assigned as a negotiator for each village. And me and a Vietnamese interpreter would go into the village, and a couple of my soil surveyors went in there with me and just messing around. But we'd have to go we'd go meet with the village chieftain, tell him what we were about, and we were going to build a road through his village. And we were going to have to destroy all the hooches and everything that was on the side of the road. They had about a 10-foot road that went through there, and we were going to turn it into a 22-foot road. Well, they were built, everything was built right on the edge of the road, so obviously we were going to tear them all down. So we'd go through there, and each individual, we'd negotiate so many sacks of cement, so many sheets of sheet metal, and some 2x4s and that kind of stuff, and gonna negotiate with each one of them exactly what he was gonna get, you know, and write it down. And at the end of the thing, he had to go to the village chieftain's house and eat dinner. And God awful. And of course, the biggest insult you could do the chieftain's wife or anything like that was to not eat anything, not eat something, you know, and not eat seconds. That was another thing. So even if you suffered through the horrible tasting, whatever it was, you know, you had to do it again. Now you know what it's going to taste like, you know, and so. It was, you know, just the kind of a thing that nobody else wanted to do, and I got stuck with it.
And so what was, what would you say, your average, if you think about your average day in Vietnam, what was that like? Walk us through what would happen on your average day.
Well, of course, we'd get up in the morning, and early in the morning, about 4 o'clock, and we'd go out on the road and work with the EOD team. And I always just went as one of the guys. It was not good to be an officer because you were the first one the snipers would shoot and think they'd take out the leadership. But so you always worked with your men just like you were one of them, you know. And it was hard to tell who the officer was and involved. So I'm out there with my bayonet just like they are. Going down the road trying to find freshly dug little holes and try to determine whether it's another number 10 can or a bouncing Betty or something, you know, or something worse. Then we get done with that about 6 o'clock, go back and eat breakfast. Guys go eat breakfast. I depend on whether or not I had meetings or stuff or had to go up the road and talk to the Special Forces guys because there was always a group of Special Forces guys close by on us, and they didn't really provide security for us, but they certainly provided entertainment at night because we could hone in on the radios and listen to what they were doing. They were crazy. But we were always doing trade for them. They had all the whiskey and all the meat and everything else you could ever want, and we had all the lumber and cement and sheet metal anybody ever want, so we were always trading with them one way or another for good food and good booze and all that kind of stuff, and we traded them sheet metal and stuff so they could build hooches with and stuff. So, and that was kind of my job also. I was a S3 officer, satellited off of a battalion company, so I wasn't really assigned to that company, so I caught a lot of crap details because I wasn't one of those company officers. Those company officers were busy with building the road, and so they couldn't be someplace else, couldn't go off and negotiate with these other guys or do any of these other things. So that's why I got stuck with doing a lot of it.
And so that would get you to lunch, and then
We'll go to lunch and then go back out there on the road. And of course, we spent a lot of time looking for gravel. My soils testing team, we didn't have any gravel over there. And we were back up on the mountains all by ourselves looking for gravel. And we figured Charlie would leave us alone, you know. And we didn't get under fire more than 2 or 3 times when I was in Vietnam, but it was almost a daily routine going up on the side of a hill and everything, doing soil samples, trying to find some kind of base material to put down. As a matter of fact, it's so bad, we wound up barging gravel in from Korea and hauling it up the road from Cameron Bay when it would come into the port at Cameron Bay, and hauling it up the road to put it on the road, you know, because we just couldn't find it. We couldn't find it anyplace. The real trick was that most of it was shale, and that sent a signal to me that oil. Mm-hmm. But you know, we've never been over a drilling. Nobody's there in 40 years, and nobody's been over a drilling. You know, even not even offshore. There's one or two attempts to drill offshore, but nobody onshore. And I still don't understand that. I still believe it was partially about oil.
That's interesting. And so you said you go back to eat lunch. Do you guys have a moving like tent that would move with you as you move down the road?
Yeah, well, we set up a base camp about 20 miles up the road from the train where the battalion was. And A Company was down about 10 miles south of the train. They were the asphalt company. They were making asphalt all the time. And they had a rock crusher if we had any rock. And matter of fact, we did have an island out off in the train about, oh, I guess about 4 kilometers, Hontray Island, and we mined that sucker as much as we could with the rock off of it, bringing it back to the rock crusher there and crushing rock to make gravel. But most of it, they crush it down and make it sizable to make asphalt with it. And so we were the only two companies that were out there at that point in time. The rest of them were back at the battalion area. And so we had a cook crew and everything else. A little quick story on that is one of the side products that Vietnam made was charcoal. People realize charcoal pits everywhere, you know, all over up and down. So you get charcoal for nothing. And we cut a 55-gallon drum in half. The officers did, of an officer's hooches. And my officer's hooch consisted of a Connex container. It's like one of the little shipping containers that the ship crossed the seas that somebody had brought up there. And I just set it in a shallow part of the ground up there, and then we covered it with my boys all covered it with dirt and stuff, just made it like a cave. And so I had dirt on all three sides and the top for Charlie was shooting rockets at us. I probably survived that. And then one just had a door and a window out the other side of it. So go in and out and see in and out. So that was my hooch, and we had several of them around. Some of them were built out of wood. Some of them were built out of sandbags and all kinds of stuff. But then we had a little circle, I guess. So we'd take the 55-gallon drum, and whatever meat we had, we grilled it on charcoal pit every day, every night, you know. And it at nighttime, you know, daytime was working on the road or looking, searching for searching for gravel or looking up advance. We were surveying out in front and make sure that we run into things we had. I can tell one surveying story. This one village had obviously was friendly, known as friendly, and had negotiated not to be tore down. So we had to detour, and we went around out through a triple canopy jungle. And we're surveying away, following all the coordinates and everything that we've been given. And lo and behold, out in the middle of this jungle, we run across a group of three Seabees and the friendly village workers. And they had built a bridge over this river, about 175-foot bridge over this river, concrete. They'd been there for 3 years. Building this stupid bridge, waiting for us to get there with the road. Can you believe that?
What's a CB?
They're Navy, Navy guys.
Okay.
And they're kind of civilian Navy guys. I don't know. They kind of got a weird ranking and stuff. But they'd been there for 3 years building this stupid concrete bridge, and we busted it right up the middle. You know where well the center line where we were going with it with. They were so happy to see us, and
so you used their bridge.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It was all predetermined, you know, oh. way before we ever got there. You know, we didn't have a clue. You know, we just assumed we'd, you know, block in the river and put in culvert pipe and stuff underneath of it. You know, like we did everything else. Every other ditch we had, we had plenty of culvert pipe. You know, so we'd just stack up culvert pipe on it and then cover that over with dirt. gravel, away you go with the road, you know. Yeah, but here was a nice 175-foot concrete bridge. And they built it with Mama Sons with number 10 cans. They'd have one of them rickshacks, wood sticks across their back, and two cans on each arm. And they'd go haul it concrete up there and dump it out in the number 10 can. That's a big orange juice can is what you're talking about.
I feel like I had a question to go back to, but I can't remember what it was now. So did you work the whole time on this one road? Is that basically it? And if so, how many miles?
Yeah, we put in 12 miles. We were supposed to do a mile a month, and in 11 months that I was out there on the road, we put in 12 miles.
So that was your Vietnam experience. You built 11 miles or 12 miles of road.
Of interstate highway. Half of an interstate highway, yeah.
All right. Did you travel while you were there? I mean, did you got time off to go places and, you know, did you have good times?
Oh, well, you had a R&R experience, but I told your mom that I didn't really want to meet her like in Hawaii, like a lot of guys were doing, because I don't want to meet her and then have to go back again. I had other places I had thought that I might go by myself, but I wound up going into the doctor's office one day at the battalion after a battalion meeting, and I had these rashes on my hand, kind of on my wrist and my hand. So I went in and see him about these rashes, and he says, well, put some of this salve on her, you know. And I said, also I got this knot on my chest that itches too, you know. And he says, he looked with that, and he took one look at that, and he said, oh, my God. I said, man, you got cancer. You got cancer all up in your armpit, you know, lymph nodes and stuff. You going to die on me over here? He said, no. Ain't having no deaths over here on me. I'm going to ship you out of here. And 2 days later, I was on a plane to Japan and went over there and had exploratory surgery. Of course, it was benign. And they said it's probably something, a lick I took whenever I got playing football and then fat bruised and then fat grew around it. And that's what the knot was, you know. But had some experiences over and got loose from the camp a couple of times. Got to ride the 100-mile-an-hour train. Got to go to Hiroshima. See what they, you wouldn't believe Hiroshima, what it looks like now. And
what it looked like then?
Well, I mean, you know, they flattened it, you know, and now it's a major metropolitan city.
Sure.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
But at the time, was it still, I mean, it's 20 years later.
Yeah, they were still building, you know, they were still building, but they had skyscrapers already and all that kind of stuff. It's just unbelievable. And I guess my only experience there is we had this one kid that had gotten, that was a Ford Observer, but he had gotten locked in. And he's another one that called an airstrike in on his own position because he was being overrun. But the only thing that happened to him is he got ripped across the stomach with 50 caliber machine gun. And so they were... they wanted that. He had had some surgeries and everything. Fortunately, they really hadn't hit any major organs, unbelievably. But they wanted all that to grow, heal from the inside out. So they'd go in there and scrape them holes out every day, you know, and just excruciating pain for him to scrape them out and then re-put in the salve and stuff. You know, they wanted everything to grow, heal from the inside out. So he wasn't allowed to go anywhere. So right before we got out of there, we took him over to the officer's club. We had this one nurse on our, I'll never forget her name, Nurse Ramirez. And she was a bad actor. She would wear red bras and underwear underneath her white uniform so you could see everything. And then she'd rip through the ward and thump everybody that had an erection, you know, and that was her big thing. So she was a bad actor. So on her shift, we took Lewis out of the ward took him over to the NCO club instead of the officers club, because they would come to the officers club looking for us. We weren't there. We were at the NCO club, and we got him all drunked up, and had a good, all of us got drunk, and we had all had a good time, you know, on Nurse Ramirez's shift. Well, of course, the doctors come in. Where are all the guys? They're gone. I don't know where they are, you know. Got her in trouble after all her renegade stuff. So that was a fun time in Japan. The other bad thing was watching television. We had television, but you couldn't understand anything. It was all in Japanese. And the only thing we really enjoyed was watching baseball games, because we could tell what was happening. And, of course, they're avid baseball players, you know, baseball games. So we could tell what was happening, but yeah, we didn't need to listen to the commentary. And the only other thing I really remember from that experience is we had a John Wayne movie on one time. And instead of having somebody with a deep, gravelly voice like John Wayne had his high-pitched Japanese guy. So every time John Wayne would speak, you know, all that crap. And, oh, man, you know. It's hard to handle.
And so did a lot of guys go to Hawaii? You know, was that a very common thing? Like one time you had to go to Hawaii or something?
Yeah, usually they take a week. They got a week in Hawaii. Or if they weren't married and stuff, they used to go to Vung Tau, which was in country. But it was they made a movie about Vung Tau. I forget now what the name of it was. But it was an in-country resort area where they could go and relax and get out of the mainstream and be more like being in America, you know.
But other than your time in Tokyo or in Japan, you were pretty much working. I mean, that was your only R&R, unfortunately, right?
Yeah, that was the only R&R I took. I wound up going there, and I thought, well, that was enough of that. Well, it was another piece of it. When I went to Japan, the doctor came in and told me, he said, well, I got good news for you and bad news for you. He said, you can go home if you want to. But your tour, the bad news is your tour doesn't count. It was your 8 months and 15 days into your tour, and you had to be there for 9 months for it to count. And I'm an officer, and I'm staying for another year, so I could see going right back to Vietnam for another year. So I opted to go back to Vietnam, finish my 3 months.
And how much contact did you have with Mom, you know, while you were there? Did you get to talk to her on the phone or just letters, and how often?
We had two systems. One, we both of us wrote letters pretty much daily. And I bought a tape recorder, and we would tape messages and send them backwards and forwards. But those were you get one of those every 3 or 4 days or something like that. So,
but other than that, you didn't never talk to her on the phone or did, talked, but only rarely?
Talked to her once, talked to her after I was in Japan and found out that everything was all right. And she's madder than hell about that.
Because you didn't want to talk to her because you thought it would be too hard for you?
Yeah, well, I didn't have any opportunity to do it any other place, you know, and I didn't want to get her worried about it. After when I got there, I could have told her I was there, but I waited until after I'd had the surgery and everything else, and she was just dumbstruck. She didn't even tell me she loved me. She was so dumbstruck that I'd call, because I said I'll never call, you know. I'll never call. I'm not going to come and see you. I'm going to do my time, and I'm going to come home. I'm one of the weird ones, I guess. There's a lot of the guys, they all went for a week in Hawaii. What the heck, you know?
Sure, why not? Yeah. Who doesn't like Hawaii? Man. And when you go to Hawaii, you've been to Hawaii now a couple times since then. Do you go there and think about that at all?
No. We're basketball fans. Yeah. And so the only times we've been to Hawaii, we've been there for the basketball tournament at Lahaina. So we just over and bleed blue.
Did you lose good friends during the war? Did you make good friends during the war?
Made good friends and only lost one. lost one.
What lessons did you take from that that you carry on in your life?
Well, of course, like I said, we learn more lessons that belong to the military. You know, I guess the treatment we got when we came home is you learn to try to teach the people, and they're doing it now, to love the warrior even though you hate the war. And the other main thing was bringing the troops in and out. I guess I solidified one thing that probably in my efforts over there, that my main forte was in dealing with people and not things. An engineer builds things, does things, but I wasn't really building anything or doing anything from that standpoint over. I was actually directing the efforts of people. And I learned it, I kind of learned it at Fort Polk. When I was a range officer at Fort Polk, our stockade was right next door to our range office. And them guys are lounging around over there smoking cigarettes and just, you know, not doing much of anything. And I was shorthanded. I needed people out there on the ranges. And so I went to the colonel and said, let me have some of them guys out of the stockade, you know. He said, well, you can't take those guys out of the stockade. They're all in there because they're AWOL, and they'll run again. I said, no, they won't run again, so I'm going to tell them right up front. I'm going to shoot their ass if they run, and I'm going to have everybody out there shoot them. I don't think they'll run, you know. And taking the bad boys out there really worked out. And I really found out most of them, yeah, they were AWOL, but most of them were in there because they couldn't handle authority, couldn't handle somebody telling them what to do or how to do it or any of that kind of stuff. And so I just tell them, hey, this is your range, okay? You're in charge of this range. I want it to work. If you need something, call me, you know, but I'm not going to be here. And these other guys, they don't have any authority over you. You are in charge of this range. You're running this range. So anytime you need help, give me a holler. I'll be happy to come help you, but it's yours. It's your baby. And they took charge of it, man, and, you know, here they go, you know. It's my range, my God, you know. All up in it, you know. And so when I went to Vietnam, I did the same thing. I took guys out of stockade there. Put them out there on the road with me, you know, and told them same thing. You run, we're going to shoot you. I'm going to tell everybody in the company to shoot your ass. And it worked every time.
And where were you? What were the cities that you went to while you were there? Where did you land? I mean, you know, what kind of would be your map of the country as where you traveled, where you went through?
Yeah, I was pretty limited. A lot of guys got all over the place, but I came into to Cameron Bay, and then shortly after that, I was assigned the battalion. They came get me in a jeep and hauled me up to Nha Trang, which used to be the old capital of Vietnam. Nha Trang was the old capital, and it's just a little bit north of Cameron Bay. And I left from there and worked about 15, 20 miles north of there on the highway. And probably I went to Quy Nhon. I used to go to Quy Nhon, get my hair cut. And because I didn't trust the guys south and up north, they didn't have any experience with the military much. So they were just non-indoctrinated people anyway, which way. So I would go up. You have to know that Vietnamese, when they cut hair with a straight razor. It's all razor cut. And the thought of him sitting there with a straight razor and behind you and your throat getting cut is pretty vivid, you know.
It makes you pretty nervous.
Yeah, it makes me pretty nervous. I used to go up there. And a little quick story, a little sideline story. We have a priest in Beaumont, Texas, that is Father Quay. And I used to pick on him all the time because he's Vietnamese. And I put two and two together. He let it slip that he was from Quy Nhon. And I put two and two together about his age and how old he was. And I told him the story a couple of times, but every time I went to Quy Nhon, there was all these kids on the corner down there hollering, "Sop, sop, G.I., which means give me something, you know, give me candy or any money, you know, anything. They're begging, actually begging. Didn't take much begging because we were always, the kids, we were always friendly to the kids. And I pinned it down. He was about 10 years old when I was in Vietnam. So I said, "You know, the more I look at you, the more I recognize you, one of them kids on that corner hall. Sop, sop, yeah." And the look on his, he's a priest, okay? And the look on his face, like, "Oh, I've been caught, you know. I've been caught out, you know." And it was worth $1 million to me. You know, just
a small world moment.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it really was. And that, you know, that having been up north like that in that kind of situation. And so that's about, Quy Nhon's about as far as I went north. And, of course, we were building two sets of roads. We were doing a side road going to Bamituit. And that's a little south of Quy Nhon, and about 15 miles east of Quy Nhon. It's in the middle of Vietnam. But,
and that's where you spent your whole time, isn't that?
That's where I spent my whole time.
A couple go backs. You said something about the special forces were always, you listened to them on the radio, and they were crazy. They were always doing crazy things. Like, what kinds of things were they doing?
Well, they were killing people, of course. But it'd be, you know, just one guy out there in the middle of the jungle someplace, and they all had nicknames that they went by. And, you know, you just sit on the radio and listen to them and say, "Well, okay, I'm in position now. This is, you know, this is Yellow Belly, you know. I'm sitting out here in the North Trail." And he said, "Well, I got to shut down now. I got some boys coming, you know." And in a few minutes, you could hear them shooting, you know. They were close enough that you could hear them shooting out there. And he'd say, "Well, I need somebody to come over and pick up six of these guys, you know." And a lot of them they'd kill without even shooting, you know. They all carry piano wire and stuff, and they'd jump on them and just pop their head off, you know. And they'd haul them down to the village and hang them upside down on a fence out in front of the village so everybody could see them. These guys were out running around in the jungle, and that's what happens to you at night. The best thing you do is stay in the village, you know.
All right.
That was kind of entertaining. That was kind of entertainment for us. If they got a big enough crew, they'd call in Spooky. And Spooky was helicopters that didn't go pop, 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 but they went, you know, and they'd get me up in the sky and they'd just pour down tracer bullets like gangbusters. It looked like, you know, looked like somebody pissing out of a big old plane, you know, up north, and they'd hit them all over the place, you know, with that. So that was visual entertainment. You know, when they'd call in Spooky, you'd wait to see where they were going to go and how many they'd wind up killing, because after they got on shooting, on them, then they'd come out and report, you know, how many they got to come pick up. They didn't leave any of them out in the jungle. That never happened. They'd drag them all out of the jungle and hang them on the fence out in front of the village every time.
So sort of like never leave a man behind.
But my area, body counts were genuine. They were not made up. Now, whether somebody inflated them up above, I don't know when it came out, but when the body counts came out, you could go out there on a fence and look at them. Yeah.
What do you remember about leaving Vietnam? What was that experience like?
Oh, leaving Vietnam. Well, for one thing, I had a couple of good friends that were 3 days behind me. So I opted to stay for 3 days, and your mother's probably never forgiven me for that. But I just didn't want to go. I didn't want to go back like I came over with not knowing anybody. So I waited 3 days for these guys to get de-roasted out, and that means reassigned. Al Coltrane's one of them. Yeah, I think you've heard me speak of Al Coltrane before, but he was one of them, and Wayne Jones was another. And when we got on the plane, unfortunately, Charlie was still shooting at them, so they took off in a vertical position. It was like going in a rocket ship, you know. Imagine what a rocket ship's like going 90 degrees up, you know, straight up. Mm-hmm. And but hostesses had on miniskirts. Yeehaw. And we hadn't seen them before. And they handed out Playboy magazines. And some of us managed to sneak on fifths of Jack Daniel's whiskey, and so it was a big time party coming home.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel like you'd accomplished anything during your time there, or you just didn't even care anymore?
Oh yeah, I knew I'd accomplished something. We'd give them something that you could be proud of. The road's still there. I've seen pictures of it. You know, it's still there. They built a lot more hooches on the side of it, and all that kind of stuff. But people have been back. Even they used the compound that we had built in the Trang as a training facility, and they will not let you in there. But because a couple of guys tried to work their way in to go look at, said, "Can I just go over to the first hooch on the right? Because that's where I was." You know, "No, you can't do that. Can you clear it out? Can you clear it out and let us go?" You know, "No, I can't do that." So, we felt like we accomplished something, and we felt like that we had good information to bring home to never do again and that kind of stuff, and built 12 miles of road.
And did you think at that time that the war would end badly, or do you feel like the war ended badly?
No. I assumed they were going to go on for 7 years and then have them trained up good enough to, and yeah, it ended badly because politicians ended it, and we didn't. The military was not ready, not fully, did not have the people fully trained in everything that they wanted to do. Consequently, they went down the tube. It was a bloodbath.
But you didn't think that was the way it was going to go when you were leaving?
No, when I left, well, see, when I left, it was 68, and they shut it down in 75. And, yeah, that's supposedly the 7 years, you know, that they talked about. But still yet, the military was not ready for them to shut it down. They didn't have them trained, and we didn't have the stuff built and everything else that we wanted to. They probably need 3 more years. Be my guess.
And you talk about other people who've gone back. Have you ever thought about going back, or did you ever want to go back?
No, I don't want to go back. That's nightmares. I'm in the back of a damn Jeep going back up to that compound, and I'm trying to figure out why I'm going again.
And so just one question to go back to on this subject. How did the war change you?
Well, like I said, it solidified that I really didn't want to be an engineer, that I wanted to manage people. So I guess that was the biggest thing. It made a career change for me. And I had visions of staying in the military up until the time I got reassigned to Fort Sheridan, Illinois, for the last 3 years, and had some bad experiences there with officers' wives that were wearing their husband's rank and abused my wife, your mother, and a few incidents that we had occurred to us. And I said, "Nah, I'm not a career officer. I'm not going to play this politics game." And in the military and the officers, it's a lot of politics. Mm-hmm. You can get to be a bird colonel on your proficiencies, on your ability to do stuff, but you can't get to be a general without politics being involved. It gets to be a political thing then, at that point in time. And I wasn't playing their game, and That would have been a ceiling for me to have broken through, and I don't think I would have ever made it, because I'm just not going to suck up to people, you know.
Right.
I'm not going to do that.
So, is there anything else you want to say about your about Vietnam, about being a soldier?
Not really. What was that question we escaped?
That was the one we just did that one. It was how did the war change you?
Yeah, how did the war change you? Yeah, I think that's the main thing. It directed me in my career where I wanted to go. I wanted to go work with people.
And where you didn't want to go.
Yeah. Yeah, and I didn't want to go and work with things anymore, you know. So.
Okay, well, we'll pause here, and maybe we'll come back, or maybe we won't. We'll see how things go. Okay.